talking about this because this is kind of interesting, kind of relevant to both of our lives, and I don't really mind if it comes up in discussion in the podcast anyway. Anyway, I have Sam on the other side. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Chris.
Rode around a fucking wet Windsor Great Park a couple of years ago, being as miserable as Sid to a Red Bull time lapse.
Yeah, I think, and it was, we agreed upon that it was like 150 watts max.
Yeah, we just sat at the front and stopped anyone doing anything. We were like, nah, fuck this. We were knackered. It was grim. I don't think you and I could be asked anymore. Both of us got basically told by our teams to go out and just ride in the shit weather. And we've sort of stayed in contact on and off since. We're currently slightly discussing and venting about property and selling properties or buying properties, as both of us are in those situations. I don't care if I say it. I don't like estate agents right now. What I was about to come on to, which I think is quite relevant for, I think what you and I will probably end up talking a bit about, is I think some people now realize it's been discussed a bit that I am selling my flat and looking to move out of London. But the stress of selling a property in the current climate, combined with this stamp duty relief, is horrible. Like, it is horrible. It's really horrible. And what I was about to say before I started recording was, like, I had like a proper breakdown this weekend. Like, pretty sure I had like a mini panic attack, because just a culmination of all of it just built up and up and up. And I was just like, fuck, this is fucking ridiculous. And my partner was like, you know, when you like, you're breathing like really, really like, we're sitting there watching some shit on TV, and like, I was thinking about it, and like, I could feel that I was like out of breath. And she is like, "Are you all right?" And I'm like, "I don't think so right now. I'm not feeling too good." So yeah, fucking stressful.
I just took 3 days off and went, I'm not adulting anymore. I'm just going to step away for 3 days. It's not going to make any difference.
What did you do for those 3 days, though? Rode your bike?
Slept, ate, and rode my bike.
I mean, that's not a bad way to spend 3 days, to be fair.
And no.
Where you currently are, you're in a lucky situation that you've got glorious riding anyway.
Yeah, it's been all right. It's been turbo. It's been, actually, since that 500K, I think I've only ridden outside like six times.
I don't blame you. Nah. Especially because we haven't, you must have had quite a bit of snow.
Yeah, my estate's not, I really struggled to get out because my estate's really, really in the shade. So it can take, you know, it's a fair whack just to get out safely. So,
yeah. You briefly mentioned it. What was this 500 kilometers you did in one day? What was it, and what was it for?
So my teammates and I basically got a bit bored in October, and we went, should we do something? My teammate being Isaac, both ride for the Upshift Nutrition Race Team, and we just went, let's do 500K in one day. So that it's the Rafa challenge, which normally takes part from Christmas Eve to New Year's Eve. Can you complete 500K? And we went, yeah, sure, why not? Let's do it in one day. So we picked like a stretch of days from the 27th to the 29th, and just weather watched, just trying to pick a decent day, knowing that at least 8 hours of it is going to be in the dark, or, you know, really, really, you know, kind of not great riding conditions. So we went from there. We managed to raise about £1,800 for Mind Charity, which is something very, very close to my heart since the passing of my mother in 2015. Mm-hmm. So it's a charity that means a lot, and I always look out for people within that. We did it in, it was a 20-hour day, so we started at 4 a.m. Well, I actually started at 2 a.m. because I had to get up and drive over to Isaac's. So I started at 2. I think I started at 2 from here, got to his. We cracked on. We'd done 130K by breakfast. We did one warm-up lap, didn't speak to each other after the warm-up lap for about 3.5 hours, just kind of like thrown off.
Yeah.
So we just did a lap each at a good whack, had some breakfast, and then we were lucky. We managed to kind of get a few groups going. So we then rode over to my house, stopped here, did a couple of fast laps on the local circuit I knew, rode back, and then it was kind of met some new people, topped up bottles, grabbed some, you know, food, and then just kind of cracked on. And then it was only about the last hour and a half, I think, the challenge for us both really started to bite.
Mm.
All of a sudden, the temperature just like plummeted. Like all of a sudden, the body was starting to shut down. You could tell that whatever you ate wasn't really doing a lot.
Yeah,
the fluids, you know, you didn't want to drink anymore because it was so cold. I mean, Isaac's done more endurance stuff than me. He's done Dale's Divide and got a really, really good result there. So he's kind of done that. This is my first kind of ultra endurance. And going into the last hour, it was just like the body was just creeping. I remember seeing 110 BPM.
Yeah.
On the front, and I'm like, I actually can't force my heart to go up. Like, it's starting to fall off whilst I'm pedaling the bike.
Yeah.
Because your body's just going, no more. Just please, just stop. But we managed to just about get it done. The last half hour was sketchy because it was starting to frost.
Mm.
So the frost was starting to lie. This was about 11:30, you know, on the 29th of December. So it's never going to be ideal anyway. And I remember getting in and we finished it, you know, saved the rides. I just remember sitting on Isaac's doorstep, just staring, like, just, and then his dad went, do you want anything? Went, yeah, can I have a coffee? Just something warm. I just couldn't sleep. I just remember just couldn't sleep for about 2 days.
Yeah.
Absolutely whacks you.
It's funny how people don't realize how much those kind of things can really take it out of you. And the cold is an additional element that I know that I definitely do struggle with more than I maybe lead on to showing.
Yeah.
And when I did the trenching challenge, for example, that was because that wasn't about, it was never about finishing it as quick as possible. It was simply about finishing it because I knew that the whole time I was doing it, the problem with Box Hill is it's so busy. So you could do one up and down in like 10 minutes and then the next one might take you half an hour. So there was, you know, doing that 91 times when one rep could be up and down half an hour, one could be 10 minutes. Like, it's so varied that it was just like, oh, well, it's just going to be what it is. It's just about finishing the reps. But I got to a point, I think it was probably about 4 a.m. when I couldn't, I was so cold and it'd been raining and everything was soaked. And I remember coming and stopping by the car and I was just like, nope, I'm going to have a snooze for half an hour and just warm up and like dry the kit out and then go again. It doesn't matter. Like there's no harm in stopping. But the cold definitely does play a big effect. So, I mean, massive respect doing that in one go over a shit time of year. And also what people probably don't think about is the December is the darkest month of the year. Like it is. And, you know, was it the 21st of December is the shortest day. So
yeah,
you're only what? 6-7 days on from that, really. So you're still,
I mean, it really was like we had to be quite meticulous of making sure we got back from like where I live in Oundle. We had to make sure we were back from the Oundle circuit back over the Market Harbour area to kind of light ourselves up for the evening stint.
Yeah.
And we out of the 17 hours of riding, I reckon we did 7.5 where we didn't have to like be concerned about lights. And it's just that's tiring. I mean, I didn't wear any form of glasses on my face for the entire thing because you're on and off with them all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I just remember getting in and just being so cold. And it was the cold that got to us in the last hour and a half.
Yeah, it's hard to explain that chill that goes to your bones, isn't it, unless you properly experienced it.
Especially then add on top of the fatigue, the tiredness, the fact that, I mean, I remember looking back and it was about a 15,000 calorie day, but that's just what you've put through the power meter.
Yeah.
So, you know, plus shivering, plus standing around, plus getting up at 2 a.m., you're looking at a 20,000 calorie day.
Yeah. Which you just can't eat. Yeah. And, you know, just general, like, body stress and nerve. And also on top of that, you've got to remember, like, day-to-day simple functioning of a body.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy 20,000 calories, probably 25 in all honesty.
Yeah.
And there's no easy way about it. Like, with these sort of rides and challenges, like, they are eating contests, but you can only eat so much. And then you just get sick of it. And it's like, I think I've read somewhere that it's called like stomach fatigue, where you just, you know, because so much of like cycling nutrition as well is sweet. It just is. That's the nature of a lot of carbohydrates at the end of the day, but you just get so fed up with sweet stuff. And the one of the like best things I've ever found was doing like citrusy flapjacks.
Okay.
Because it's like a palate cleanser. It kind of cuts through the sweetness, even though it's still a sweet food. It's not as, it's got that citrusy flavor helps cut through it. And the other one is roast potatoes. Honestly.
Yeah. See, talking potatoes, on one of like the local loops we did, at the bottom of the roundabout was McDonald's, and I remember with 2 hours to go, all I could taste was chips. I was like, "Mate, can we just stop for some chips?" Because that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
But I remember also, I remember getting about 10 hours in, and I stood next to Isaac, went, "I really fancy something sweet. Like, I just wanted a sugar hit." I was like, "No," because my flatmate Charlie, he'd done a 500K, but in the summer.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, whatever you do, try not to hit a gel or any sweets, because it's not that sort of fuel you need. And I remember going to Isaac, and he goes, have it. I went, no. And I just found something salty instead. I think I had like a peanut butter and salt bagel. Yeah. And that did the treat, because I was too worried about the sugar. Yeah, you need the sugar, but you're out for such a long day. You're not really burning kind of those real fast sugars.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Remember. You want the slow-burn carbs at the end of the day. So bread is great for that as well. It's really, really good. Saurine, that's one of my go-tos.
Yeah.
If you get saurine and put peanut butter in it, you're onto an absolute winner. Like,
100%.
I just
remember just trying to get all the fluids in.
Yeah, because you take so much of your carbohydrate through your drink as well.
I remember because I'm renowned for drinking, and Isaac actually, and he won't mind me saying this, he got pissed off with me towards the end. I was stopping every 2 hours for a piss. And I said, there's no harm in that, mate. There's no harm in that. I must have had a bottle an hour, easily.
Good that you kept it up, because that's normally the first thing that falls.
Yeah.
That is. I know. No. That, I get to a point where I struggle with drinking, definitely. And in the cold, it is a lot harder, because you're not.
Yeah.
You're not. I mean, you are dehydrating, but you're not dehydrating kind of to the same levels as you would in the summer, where you instinctively feel dehydrated, so you want to drink. While in the winter, you know, you are still dehydrating your body, but not kind of the same way. I would say it's hard. It's really hard to explain unless you've done it yourself. And I don't think there's many people that are stupid enough to want to do it themselves, to be perfectly honest with you, which is fine. No. There's nothing wrong with that.
What, as in the dehydration or ride 500K in a day?
Both.
Both?
Or 500K in a day in the winter, I would say.
Yeah. Well, we did sit down and chat the other day, and we both went, so what are we doing next? Because what can you do? Like, you know what 500K is like. So you're going to go out and do it again. You're going to get to the 300K mark and go, all you can think about is how grim that next 200 is.
Yeah.
So it's like, what's next?
That is my pet hate question. I hate it. I really hate it, because it puts a pressure on you that you have to do something.
Yeah.
In reality, I mean, like for me, I know that like longer distance stuff, I'm it's what I'm good at. Is I'm much better at it. I can sustain it. I mean, it's interesting when, you know, we sort of talk a bit, you know, you race. So we have a slightly different mentality to how, I mean, I race, but not races like you. For me, it's like there's a huge long build up to a race or challenge, whatever it is. Then there's said challenge. And then there's probably a month and a half of doing pretty much fuck all because I'm screwed for it. And then it's long build up again. And that's just the nature of endurance stuff. But yeah, the whole what's next thing is like, it's my biggest hated question. And I think, to have done what the problem is what you guys have done is now you've done 500K and done it in the winter. 500K in the summer is easy in comparison.
Yeah.
I guess it's going to be interesting because it will really depend on what races end up happening this year. If you guys end up getting some racing in, I know Isaac signed up to do GP Duro.
Yeah, he's down. He's in.
He's pestering me to do it for ages. I was just like, oh, bugger it. I'll put an entry in anyway.
Did you get in?
Yeah, got in. And then he's been asking me like, what bike am I going to do it on and all this kind of thing. I was like, mate, I haven't got a clue. It's so far away, as far as I'm concerned. But
he is a notorious planner.
I can tell that. I can tell that. And he's a lovely kid. And Isaac helped me out when I was doing the 107 TDF. He went to a little bike shop called Mega Bike.
That's the one.
Live near Market Harbour away and you don't know it, go and check it out. If you do know it, give them some love, might as well. Help me out a very important time towards the end of the challenge when I was fucked. I was shelled. The last maybe 3 or 4 days was about survival at the end of the day. And I was on my third, it would have been my third rear tire, basically. I absolutely just destroyed two tires previously, and a lot of that is the additional weight on the bike, to be honest with you, just having the weight over the back of the bike. I didn't start with brand new tires because I thought if I went started with brand new tires, I'm gonna have a set of half used tires, which is, and that just to me, and then putting half used tires on a bike again, I'm always like, I don't like that. So I'll use the half used tires till they're fucked, and replaced them as and when I needed to. That was my theory. But the front one lasted the whole thing. The rear one, by the time I got to Mega Bike, I was on, that was my third tire. The second tire lasted like 4 days and then it was absolutely shagged. And then the first tire lasted from London to Land's End to John O'Groats and then back a little bit, which is, that's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I think it gave up by, where would it have been? Inverness was where that tyre, on the way back down by Inverness. So it was pretty impressive. Yeah, the second one was shite. Lasted 4 days and got ripped off very quickly at Mega Bike. And I also had like I couldn't get my headset tight at all. Don't know why. And I was just like, I literally was like, I couldn't, my mind was so tired, I couldn't figure it out. So I just was like, can you help? And he figured it out. So it was pretty okay for the rest of the ride. But long and short of it, the like compression bung was knackered, which riding a bike off-road that wasn't supposed to be ridden off-road probably did that, in all honesty. Yeah. Your team, it is your team.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about your team. It's
the only thing I will clarify, which has come up in my DMs recently, is I don't work for Upshift. A lot of people think I work and own Upshift, and it was just something I wanted to clarify. They sponsor me. They're the title sponsor. I don't work for them. I wish. He's a lovely chap. He's a really, really nice chap, and I've known him for many, many years through different companies. So it was called something previously. Shift but up. Then he no. No. But down no. Kids? So they're just the title sponsor. We were known as Active Edge initially, which is when you and I trundled round, you know, Windsor Park on a Sunday morning. I think that's a good definition of how that Sunday morning ride went.
Right, yeah, spun round mode. What? So how did the team all sort of start? Because it's been, it feels like the team's kind of got quite a lot of good traction. So some strong riders in the team. And there's been strong riders who've been part of the team throughout the years, hasn't there, really?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, after my mum passed away, I was a big chap, I was a personal trainer, water polo player. And I kind of just took up cycling from there. Yeah. Like, I'd had an endurance background, always done endurance sport, national level swimmer. So I'd always had kind of that engine. And with my mum passing away in the spring, I kind of just started riding my bike from there. And then I met a coach and it became very much about a weight loss. He went, you're fine, but you're going to get to a hill and you're going to go backwards. I mean, at this point, yeah, I was a big guy in terms of cycling. Wasn't necessarily in, you know, in inverted commas, fat, but I was carrying for sure. So it all very much became about weight loss. And it kind of just started from there, really. So I spent the next 18 months, 19 months, just on a constant up, down with food, exercise, poor relationships with food and exercise. Moved out to Thailand. So lived in Chiang Mai, which was just hilly. You know, I was living at the bottom of a mountain that was essentially anywhere from a 30-minute full gas effort to 2 hours, you know, up to altitude, you know, really proper climbing. Doi Si Te, you know, it's one of the most famous temples in Chiang Mai. So it was all about just being super lightweight. And I remember going through periods out there, like every ride was fasted, like nothing, you know, copious amounts of coffee beforehand. Would eat afterwards, for sure. And then I kind of decided in mid-2017, after some particularly scary health results and blood tests, that I wasn't to go back to Thailand. I just decided this is not the place. So I just started racing for a local club in Peterborough. I just raced for Peterborough Cycle Club. Picked a couple of race wins that year, got four, haven't run away since. Also, all pretty much solo efforts with two laps to go. I actually beat one of my current teammates and I don't let him down. Because he didn't know who I was. And I just clipped up the hill. He nearly caught me. He still reminds me he nearly caught me. But he'll also say that I sat on for the entire ride as well.
Part riding, surely.
Well, no, but I was the unknown rider, so I can do that, right? So yeah, so got to the end of that season and I kind of went, I can do something with this. I'd kind of picked up a few personal sponsors in terms of products along the way. And I just had to sit down and chat and went, well, I can form a team off the back of this. It's gonna help me kind of come out of my depression, anxiety, bring me back into society, really. So formed a team back end of 2017, primarily aimed at just local lads. There'd been a local kind of local crits that had been happening over the summer, kind of just formed friendships and went from there. And then I went to Mallorca 2017 with Lawrence Carpenter and Lawrence Kirby. And that was at the time that Catford was folding. So I think Lawrence Carpenter had something in the pipelines anyway, but I've known
Ribble.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I'd known Kirby for a while. So I offered him a ride on the team. And obviously being out in Mallorca with Carpenter, he shoves a camera in front of your face. So, you know, he did that and we put a vlog up. And from that, I actually got an email from a chap living in New Zealand who is English. And we got talking and he joined the team. So all of a sudden we've gone from 6-7 lads around Peterborough to Lawrence Kirby from Essex Way and a lad that was coming back called Toby, who was coming back from New Zealand for the year. So he joined us. He actually lived with me for the year. So he turned into a flatmate, which was really good. And but those two just lifted the level of the team so much that we just progressed like really fast, but potentially too fast. Mm-hmm. Like we had to try and bring the level down. I mean, Toby went out to the RAS Mun and finished second overall.
There's a lot.
Yeah. You know, and Kirby won a couple of national Bs. Toby had numerous second places, got beaten by Russ Downing at national B in the North. I was rebuilding my health. So I was doing a lot of low, steady miles. My season came at the end, basically. I just got on a really good run, basically from divisionals. Mm-hmm. I think I had 5 second places in like 8 races and everything else was a top 5. Hadn't had much, but we just grew from there. And I remember sitting on my phone in August and just messages coming through. I went, oh, this is what it's like. Because I hadn't really understood it and then started to get to know. And then going into 2019, we had a bit of a rebrand and I went big. It was now just myself running the team. My ex-partner, we split up during those kind of bad times when I was struggling. So kind of run the team on my own since then. And I probably went a bit too big. We did like an elite team and a development team. So there was 18 of us at the time.
Big jump up.
Yeah. Yeah. Big jump. And I managed to grow the budget as well, but obviously I'd grown the team. So it didn't always that. And then 19 was a fantastic season. We had Jim Bradford, who was winning National Bs left, right, and centre. Felix, who is just an awesome tester and National A rider, Prem rider, could give him 4 days notice and he'll get round the Prem. You know, he was just out of this world. I mean, I had half of the Cambridge University lot on my team at one point. The only person I missed off the list was pretty much Bradbury and David Hewitt. Yeah. But David came along to a couple of events. So we kind of grew from there. But the ethos was always around, you know, I'm not somebody that just gives stuff out. I'm like, you have to earn your spot. Just go and race. You know, I'm not massive into the kit. I'll try and get all your clothing and a load of sponsor products, but I'm not bikes. I just want you boys to go out there, race and understand what it's like. And we can come on to like the ethos behind it in a minute. And that's kind of what we did. So 19 grew. And then as with every team, whatever sport, people decide to, you know, go different ways. They quit, they move teams. So we lost a few riders. One rider signed for a better team, which was great. And that's what I love. The idea is that I can provide that platform onto maybe a slightly better elite level team. I'd call us elite. We are elite, but there are higher level elite riders. So Jim moved over to Richardson's Trek, which was a great move.
And it's a team with so much history to it as well. You know, it's been around for a long time.
Exactly. And, you know, Andy Lyons there runs a great little setup. So he stepped up, a couple of lads quit. They just didn't want to ride their bike anymore, which is like, that's fine. But then my inbox still grows and went, I'm not going to grow it. So I kept the team real small. And then Active Edge, they had to pull out as title sponsor last minute. So it was a massive, massive hunt for January, February of 2020 to find a new title, new kit, new design. Got it done, courtesy of Neil at Upshift. After a bit of badgering, we managed to come to an agreement. So we renamed and then COVID struck. And it kind of went, we got it all ready, brand new kit, great kit, and then bang.
Yeah, you can talk at the end of the day.
No, but we still, as a team, we still were really close. Isaac got 4th at Divides Dale, so did really, really well there. Ollie Peckover and Jack secured some great CTT results. So that's where we're quite well-rounded. We've got a couple of guys that are reasonable on Zwift as well. So that's kind of where it's grown. But going all the way back, it's basically a team that's founded off the back of my eating disorder and depression. So within most conversations I have with the team, it's always like, are you okay? You know, where's your training at? You know, there is more to life than just bike riding. You know, yes, you can ride your bike, but, you know, riding a bike does have to be fun. And that's something I still battle with every day. I've had a conversation with Isaac about it this morning. You know, it's very, very easy to fall into that path of, you know, exercise to earn food, you know, exercise to, you know, feel good, you know, and that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's funny, I can do 4 hours fasted still. I can still go out, do four. I can't sit at home for 4 hours and not eat, but I can ride my bike for 4 hours and not eat. And it's that sort of attitude. But when I came to the sport, that was kind of put upon me. Like, you didn't need to eat. You know, you've got enough fat in your body to fuel you. Protein shakes weren't a thing. You know, carbs in your bottle definitely weren't a thing. And then looking back into last year, I kind of, after when I lockdown happened, and I thought, right, I'm just going to ride my bike like full time. I've got two jobs. They're both secured. I'll just ride my bike. And I've never eaten so much food in my entire life. Yet I was stronger, leaner, probably skinnier in inverted commas than ever before.
It's such a tricky thing, isn't it? And it's why I was really keen to talk to you, because I know, like, I used to be very overweight. My biggest, I was 120 kilos. The lightest I've ever been is 73 kilos. And at 73 kilos, my power drops considerably.
Yeah.
And I feel the cold really badly. You know, I am 185 centimeters, so just short of 6 foot. I'm not the tallest guy in the world. I'm not the smallest guy in the world. My probably best weight is anywhere between 75 and probably just over 80 kilos. And at the moment, I probably sit around 80 kilos. And a lot of people go, 80 kilos for a cyclist, that's heavy. But actually take that out of perspective. 80 kilos for a fit and healthy young man, that's not heavy. That's actually quite that's a very healthy weight. It's incredibly heavy weight. And unfortunately with cycling, there's such an obsession with weight when I think it started to change. And I say that because we see the likes of Wout van Aert, who is like nearly 90 kilos and winning, you know, leading the Jumbo Visma up a mountain in the Tour de France. Or Filippo Ganna, who is 100 and something kilos and goes and just rides away from everyone. So like we're starting to see that there is maybe a change of perception on that, because it's coming from the top end.
Yeah.
But the problem is that's going to take a year, 2 years, 5 years maybe to really filter down that weight isn't everything in cycling. You know, as I said myself, when I was 73 kilos, I couldn't sustain the power numbers I couldn't sustain at 70, you know, 80 kilos really.
At 70 kilos, I couldn't walk upstairs to bed.
There you go. That says a lot about it, doesn't it?
When I was severely underweight, I couldn't do anything, you know. And I know I put that story up on my Instagram yesterday. You know, he's lost 3 years of his career. I lost 4 years of my life because it was that bad. Couldn't sleep because your body's too stressed. Yep. Couldn't walk upstairs. I had to take 2 years away from work. And it's, mine was kind of instilled upon me, and I carry all of that on my shoulders as well, that, you know, I should have seen different, but at the time I couldn't. And when
you're in the situation, that's the thing.
Yeah. And it was a method of control around my mother's lot, around the loss of my mother, you know, and it was something along those lines. But I just remember being so light that, you know, I had no energy. I mean, would I have sat here and spoken to you? Probably not. You know, and it's that sort of energy level that dips. And I think what you've also got to remember, you see all these guys that put their weight up on Zwift or Pro Cycling Stats. Half the time, it's not even true. Half the time, it's the lightest weight they've ever been after they've been sick for 2 days and haven't had a bottle of water in 4 hours.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Half of it's not even true. And at the end of the day, it depends what mass you've got. You know, I've spoken to Harry Tanfield a load of times. He is ripped. Like, he is absolutely solid muscle, but he's considered a bigger guy. And I'm like, so what are you going to do? Take some muscle away from him and he's going to lose his power. Yeah. You know, it's at the end of the day, people are built for different things. You know, I'm slightly taller than you. I'm 190. Mm. I don't track my weight anymore. I don't own scales. I don't know. Which has its swings and roundabouts. Some days I feel overweight and some days I feel underweight. So I just have to go on feelings.
And to be honest, that's, for you, is definitely the right decision. I probably weigh myself once a month. That's it.
Yeah. So at my peak, I was weighing 10 to 12 times a day.
Yeah.
I wasn't leaving the door, especially when I was in Thailand, until I saw a certain number on the scales. Hold my hands up. I've got an addictive personality anyway, to anything. I'm full gas or no gas. That's how I kind of live. So I don't own scales anymore. As my dietitian said to me, Sam, your scales probably stopped working because you stepped on them so much. You know.
To be fair, it's probably true. But
cost me a fortune in batteries.
I mean, the thing with it's, I find it very, it's very refreshing. You're very open about it because it's not something that many cyclists will openly talk, not just cyclists, people will talk about. There is, especially I think with younger riders and just people in society, where there's so much pressure on social media and pressure with, like, especially in the cycling sense, there's so much pressure from young guys to go, oh, I need to be this weight so I can perform at this, you know, blah, 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 whatever it is. Or, you know, I need to get leaner. I need to get me faster. But part, the big thing that to remember is that genetics play a very big part in cycling. Probably, I mean, you look at the like the extreme ends of performance in cycling. There's people who are those outstanding performing people genetically are very different. Chris Froome, incredibly tall. Incredibly skinny. That is his natural build. You know, that's how he's built up. His riding style. No one else rides like him. That's his style. No one else really wants to ride like him, shall we be honest? But and then as I mentioned earlier, Ganna, huge guy, huge engine, complete anomaly to what would be considered a traditional cyclist aesthetically.
Right.
You know, super, super powerful, super strong. You look at the people that win the Grand Tours, maybe there is a bit more of a similarity on Grand Tour riders in the men's side anyway, but generally they're, you know, very lean, very thin guys. Another example, Bradley Wiggins, when he won the Tour de France, there was nothing of him in comparison to what he is now or when he was on the track. Like, he's a bigger build guy, but he's very tall. He's very, you know, he's a tall guy. On the women's side of the sport, it does feel like it's a bit more of an open playing field.
Absolutely.
And part of that is, you know, I think women's racing is better to watch, to be perfectly honest, at the top levels. It's much more open field, much more interesting. There's obviously certain teams that on paper probably have stronger riders, but it's way more of an open playing field. Like, you know, I know Ashley Moulman-Passio very well, and she could, you know, she's the, as you know, the virtual world champion, Zwift world champion. And
yeah.
That's one very distinct style of racing, and it is a type of racing, definitely now, 100%. Equally, she could be winning up a mountain. Equally, she could go and win on a couple of classics. You know, there's definitely something about the women's side which is a bit more all-round. But same thing, there's a very, you know, all shapes and sizes in the peloton, but people maybe quite often only look at who's winning, which I think is part of the issue with where weight becomes a problem in cycling.
And what people don't realise is, and I had this discussion with a good friend, Andy Turner, who I've done Red Bull with as well, and it's like, you don't realise how little bone density these guys have.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys fall on the floor at 2 mile an hour and they have broken vertebrae, broken hips, collarbones. You know, there is a reason these guys do break, you know, because their bones are just fragile. You know, remove 2 kilos of bone mass and there you go. You know, you're 2 kilos lighter, you're already at race weight.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I remember I had a bone density test done. And I was about a 75-year-old male. And I was told, do not go out riding in the winter, because if you hit the floor, Sam, you'll probably break your hip.
That's scary.
You know, yeah. And when you put the weight on, you naturally think it's other stuff, but it could just be bones.
Yeah.
You know, I'm similar to you. I'm not a short chap, and I've, from my past, I've got quite broad shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, I can't just cut them off, you know.
I had a bone, like a DEXA scan, and and that comes up with all your bone density, your muscle fat, all that kind of
thing.
And I used to play rugby, so my bone density is really high because of all the small fractures and breaks in rugby. It just is. And like, you know, you think in rugby that anytime you have an impact, you could potentially be slightly cracking or damaging your bones because of a small stress fracture. Like, I'm talking tiny, tiny things, but it then grows back stronger, which adds on weight. So when I had my DEXA scan, my bone, I can't remember what the number was, but it was like ridiculously high. So even when I was at my thinnest, I still thought I was big because I was still heavy. Like, but that's just something that genetically is me.
Yeah. You know?
And even when I was overweight, like even to now, like I have a stomach and, you know, I try hard to get rid of it as much as I can. You know, every day I do like an hour of like basically core work.
Yeah.
And for me, that's more the reason why I started doing that was because I made a real conscious change about trying to be strong as opposed to trying to be like thin/lean. And I got hit by a van in 2019 and I had so many issues with my back from that when I got hit by the van. And it meant I needed to take this like stance to strengthen my back. And that has been just like every day, half an hour to an hour, just trying to like work on core strength because it's incredibly important. And a lot of cyclists forget that. And slowly it's definitely getting better, but genetically, the point I'm getting to is some people genetically would get absolutely ripped doing that.
Yeah.
And other people wouldn't. And I'm one of those people that wouldn't. And that's fine. That's just individual people. And we're all individual.
You can relate that back to academia as well. You've got the chaps that get, you know, A stars. They can sit at the back of the classroom, sit on their phone and don't even have to revise. But you've also got the chaps, they get all the A stars, they're at the front, you know, and they work their backsides off. And it's the same in cycling. Some people are just very genetically gifted and have it. And some, unfortunately, have to work bloody hard.
Yeah.
And it goes both ways. But it's like coming back to the bigger chaps, and I've sat down, the bigger chaps or the guys that carry that little bit extra, you'd be amazed at the repeatability it brings to your training.
Mm.
The chaps that are running, you know, right on the edge all of the time, they might have one or two efforts in them. I know since I've gained the weight, my ability to back up effort after effort after effort is, normally I grow into a session. I very rarely tail off.
Yeah,
unless it's sprints or 1 minute efforts, then I very rarely tail off. And that's around the fueling and being a slightly bigger guy. Because you do need that. And I know I pushed myself on that 500K.
Yeah.
I could tell that I was getting coming up to the event, I probably dieted in inverted commas a bit too much because I was so cold.
Like,
and I'm the same as you. When I start dropping weight, I get cold.
Yeah. I just looking when you're talking about repeatability, I was just trying to find the session that I did yesterday, which was a warm up, quite a long warm up. I have to have long warm ups because otherwise I just feel like shit.
Yeah.
It was like 10 minutes at zone 3, minute off, and then 7 times, 30 seconds in zone 6, 7.5 minutes in zone 3, like top end zone 3.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing that 7 times, basically. And the first couple, I always feel like shit. I just do. But then after like 2, I'm like, yeah, I could probably do 15 of these. Like,
yeah.
And it was in total, you know, it was a lot of work in sort of like mid to top zone 3. But in reality, I could have just sat and carried on doing that. And as you said, like having that extra bit of muscle allows you to be able to repeat those kind of sessions, I think, which is, you know, if you're looking at like, it does definitely help with like ultra distance racing. Definitely. Yeah. Time trialing definitely helps. Road racing considerably helps, you know.
Especially in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely in the UK. The kind of
race. Until you go to Tour de Rez, you're not really on anything massively, massively steep or long. There's a couple of the Northern National Bs, but if you've got a reasonable 5-minute power or something, and you can just suffer, you'll probably be all right.
Yeah. And normally, I know when I've been chatting with my coach, Ken, whenever there's a hilly race, he will just put himself as close to the front of the peloton and just let himself roll back. And he'll be still in the peloton by the time he's got over a hill. Because and that comes down to being smart and knowing how to the race and, you know, cope with your, I guess, your mentality of racing as well. And I really hope that more younger riders start to understand that you don't need to be starving yourself. Like, I keep seeing it and it's really concerning because long and short of it, as you've already said, cycling, it is part of your life. It's not, it shouldn't be the means and ends to everything. You know, if it's your everything, what the fuck are you going to do if you're injured?
Yeah.
You're going to go stir crazy. You need to have other outputs, other ways to keep yourself, you know, motivated to do anything, you know, whether that is baking, you know, drawing, painting, whatever it is, you need to have something external from the sport.
And it is a fucking long road to recovery. I mean, my testosterone hit male levels start of 2020. And that I had my first test done in 2017. Because if you combine the health issues along with the mental issues that the eating and starvation brings you, they're a constant battle. You might think your health is coming up and then you struggle because you think you're gaining weight. So you start dropping the health off and you have to ride the roller coaster. Mm. It took me a year and a half of no more than zone 3 work. And most of it was zone 2. I remember when I first met your coach, Ken, out in Calpe, I wasn't allowed to do anything more than 3.5 hours and nothing more than 300 watts if I did any efforts.
Yeah,
I remember I did one bash up Sacralobra that December with Carpenter, and the email I got from my coach was very long because my body couldn't handle the stress at the time.
Yeah. I really hope that, you know, your story is very relevant to a lot of people.
I just don't want anyone to go through what I went through.
Because
when, you know, I lost a prospering career, essentially I lost family, friends, and at the time my fiance, because my world just spiraled because I didn't see anything else apart from the bike and a lettuce leaf, to put it bluntly.
Yeah. It's I feel like especially you know, what's really important to highlight is that unless you are racing at that very, very top level, this you don't need to be measuring those macros to that level, in my opinion.
No. And the guy, and you don't also know what the top guys are doing. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, but they are very, very well looked after. They don't have to do much for the rest of the day, you know, ultrasound, recovery, massages, you know, sleep. But they also eat a hell of a lot on the bike.
Yeah.
They don't stop on the bike. They might not have a lot before, they might not have a lot after, but they smash food on the bike.
And a big part of that is because there a lot of pros understand that you need to, you know, the moment that hunger knock comes, it's you're in a deficit at that point. You're past that deficit. And fueling when you're riding is so, so important to being able to continually train hard, perform well. And not just for that day, is it if you don't fuel well for the particular day, you're putting the next day or the next day or the next day in detriment.
Yeah.
People forget that side of it a lot.
If you're fit and going well, you can probably have a good breakfast and get around 4 hours on, I don't know, maybe a couple of bananas or something light. You'll get round, but the day after you might feel a bit iffy, but the day after is all of a sudden you'll see that power just fall off the face. Mm. Or you end up overeating for what might be an easy day because you didn't eat enough on that long day.
Yeah, exactly. Now, thank you for being so open and honest. I should definitely say that because it's a very tricky subject to discuss. And as someone like yourself who's been, you know, has really ridden the wave, so to speak, it's very refreshing to hear you being so honest about it and also kind of saying it as it is, like, you know, and how it's affected you over such a long period of time. And how I always like to try and wrap up podcasts is I ask for like 5 tips. And I feel like these tips could be kind of anything, but I actually feel like what would be really, you from your own personal experience, these could be anything what you want. It could be absolutely anything from bike stuff, nutrition, cooking, whatever. But I feel like it's really important that these 5 tips should be something that's actually very focused around the things we're kind of discussing.
Yeah.
Like what would be your advice to like five things to help out with like, you know, new cyclists maybe, or people who want to get into racing?
First one is teach yourself to eat on the bike. Find something that you're comfortable with.
Mm.
And yeah, find something you're comfortable with. And I would say, regardless of how, unless you're under an hour, eat something. Even if you're doing an hour and a half cafe cruise, might not eat on the ride, but have something to eat at the cafe. Yep. But have something. Try not to go too long. Regular, you know, the whole old school bodybuilding, eat every 2 hours. Try and eat regularly.
Hmm.
Protein shake. Recover as soon as you physically can. Because it does stop the binging late at night.
Hmm.
And at the end of the day, if you're an athlete, if you're on back-to-back sessions, I definitely knock back a protein shake of some sort. If it doesn't feel too strenuous, you know, okay. But get some form of protein and carbs in immediately. Eat. I don't like intuitive eating.
Yeah.
But eat more than you think.
Yes, I agree.
You know, I go to friends, I've got a support bubble. They go, you're having 2 packets of rice. I'm like, I did ride my bike for 3 hours today and you're having a whole packet of rice. So I think I can have 2. You know, don't feel judged. Same with salt. Why are you pouring so much salt on? Because I need it.
Have a lot of it. People often forget that 3 hours of exercise is a long time.
Yeah. That's the next one. Don't, and I fall for this still, don't underestimate 3 hours being a small day. however fit you are, an hour, even 2 hours is a lot of exercise.
It is.
I think that's where people fall down. Mm. 2 hours is a, you know, it's a good day on the bike. You know, you're talking at, you know, 1,500 calories worth. It's still, you know, an additional that you need to find. So don't underestimate how much you train.
Mm. I think we're on four.
I personally, yeah. I personally wouldn't worry about weight. If you're riding in the UK, unless you're super competitive on Zwift, and I don't know, you're looking potentially within the next year to step up a level, I really wouldn't worry about UK. If you're weighing in, yeah, you know, don't be excessive, but carrying an extra kilo with the temperatures in the UK, I really don't think will do you much harm.
Completely agree with that one, especially when you bring up temperatures, because reason why I say that is I look at the kind of racing I do. There's no one who is hyper skinny or lean that does that kind of racing.
And me and my mates talk about it all the time. Look at the chaps who were at the front of the World Championships in Harrogate.
It's the big guys.
They're not skinny. And they should have been.
Yeah.
They should have been the skinny chaps, because of the amount of climbing.
Yeah.
Those guys don't have the body fat to get them round.
It's true.
Or the muscle mass.
And it's completely true. And you know, I look at, yeah, I'm good friends with Mark Beaumont. Mark Beaumont is a unit of a man. He's huge. He's got, yeah. I don't know, he's 6 foot something. He's noticeably taller than me. Massive shoulders on him. He's a big guy. That guy's ridden around the world faster than anyone else in the world. You know, it's, I think, kind of to lead on from what you said, is don't try and cheat what your body's natural form is. That's no. Quite important.
My dietitian always says your body will sit. So this is Reenie, your body will all sit where it wants to sit.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll go over. You'll always easily go over. But if you're going under, your body won't be happy. And that's when you know.
Yeah. Like, as I know,
you can't force it.
Yeah. And as the prime example of that is, I know that my body is probably happy around, happiest probably between 77 and 82 kilos, that 5 kilo. And that's pretty, there normally is about a 5 kilo sort of deficit, or, you know, either way, really, there's a 5 kilo sway on it. And, you know, you just need to, you bear in mind, one thing to say as well is the pros, they will get to race weight just for the race. It's not something they stay at all.
You beat me to it. Look, you know, why didn't Froome and Geraint go to the Tour? Because at the Dauphiné, they were still overweight.
Yeah.
So they go, well, I'm not going to sacrifice performance. Now, I'm going to give myself another whatever, 6 weeks it was, or whatever it was with last year, to drop that weight. I'm not going to starve myself instantaneously.
Mm. Which is good.
They might rush. Yeah, they might run it that way, what, twice a year? Once a year. Maybe twice a year if it's Olympics, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on the circuit, of course. But
yeah,
these guys are performing at the optimum with millions of pounds of support around them. Scientists, nutritionists, the best coaches in the world for the sport, you know. The caliber of support these guys have at the top end is pretty insane. And
I've heard these guys don't shake their own protein shakes.
Oh man, that's a slightly depressing
because they don't have the energy.
Yeah.
There was a local test around here that wouldn't brush his teeth before a time trial because it was too much energy.
Oh, fucking hell.
There's a note to end on.
That is a very nice point to end on. So basically, don't be a fucking idiot. And I say this in a jokey context, but this is a very serious topic, and I really appreciate you, Sam, talking about it so openly, because I feel like it's something that, you know, I have a bit of an obsessive personality as well. When I was trying to drop weight, it got obsessive, and I think it's actually quite dangerous. And, you know, the biggest thing I can say out of it is we choose to ride our bike for fun. We're not really paid to do it. It's a choice, and it's a lifestyle that we do for the fun of it and for our own pleasure. If we, you know, you don't want to be putting your life at risk for when you're older. You know, bone density is something, especially as you get older, which is a real concern for a lot of people. And if anyone can take anything out of this, is just like, take a step back and reassess yourself, and maybe understand that, you know, there's a bigger picture, but also be really conscious that there are people who can help and support, who you can go out and talk to. And the, you know, your detriment to that as someone who's very willing and open to talk and help people, and, you know, and the people that you know as well in your circle who, you know, dietitians, coaches, etc. There's so much support out there if you are struggling.
The list is endless that I can help people with. I've got people left, right, and center that are brilliant. Rene McGregor's one, Nikki Kie.
Yeah.
Nikki Kie, which is the mother of a rider on my team, Jamie Francis. Mm-hmm. So she's really good. She's a hormone expert. Rory Thomas Brown, he's a legend. He works with Rene. Very similar to me. Mid-20s, just lost his weight with food. And the Train Brave podcast is brilliant. There's loads more, but they're the three I've always worked with. They're always open. I think Rini's super busy because eating disorders have picked up over COVID massively, and people fell back. But they really are, in my opinion, the leading sports ones in the UK. They really are fantastic.
Awesome. So thank you, Sam, for your time.
No problem.
And maybe we'll see each other again in a wet and miserable park somewhere riding around in circles.
Probably
not.
No. I might, if you're on GP Duro with Isaac, I might can stand on the side of the road somewhere and see you.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Awesome, mate. No stress at all, buddy.